specifically the Hispanic and Asian population in this county are receiving fewer home and CDBG service, or accessing our projects and services at a lower proportion than you would expect based on your representation in the county, you know, the population that is there. So that is not a problem that is specific or limited to home and CDBG. We are actually also seeing it throughout the homeless continuum of care. We've spoken with the city of Vancouver, and they've also been seeing same populations. And this past year, they funded the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, the same program that was presented, one of the same programs that was presented to you this past year, and apparently that has helped a lot in terms of boosting the numbers of who's being served. But the bottom line is we need to figure out how to do more outreach. We think there's some cultural reasons why services are not being accessed at the same rate when people fall into poverty and the Hispanic population specifically. We think that they lean a lot more on their social networks and family and friends for assistance before they go to public assistance of some kind. But with, you know, we're looking, we've asked our housing service providers to provide more translated materials, do more deliberate outreach to all the communities in our jurisdiction, and that's something that over the next year, actually over the next 3 years, we're going to be, you know, specifically working on, you know, improving our outreach and numbers. So that's the one area that I think you really need to be aware of at this point. And I'm not going to, unless someone has a specific question, I'm not going to go into every single project and how much we spent. But I am going to go over the totals, and in you have the summary in front of you. But you know, you'll see that in community centers for Columbia River Mental Health, for Community Services Northwest, and for Washougal Community Center, we spent out a total of $394,440.94. Park improvements, which were with Yackel, we spent $101,984.86. Street and pedestrian improvements in Battleground, Camas, Ridgefield, and Woodland, we spent a total of $391,778.83. And in housing CDBG activities, between rehab, the TBRA case management, and Proud Ground home ownership, we spent out a total of $654,500. Our 20% CDBG admin was $299,450.28. So the total CDBG funds expended in 2015, which is, you know, that program year's July 1st, 2015 to June 30th of this year, was $1,842,154.91. For home, projects that had some kind of funding activity during that period of time were REACH, Isabella Court, Lincoln Place in Vancouver, Community Services Northwest with their CHET program, Janice Youth with the Nest Housing Program, and Sheriff's Fire. We spent out a total of $738,627.07. Only 10% of admin allowed for home, which was a total of $46,643.30. So the total home funds expended this past program year were $784,270.37. So if you have any specific project questions, you know, we'd be happy to drill down on them. But that's the basic overview. Okay, that's all I have to report on that.
Thank you. And then also, Michael, you've got the 2017 application update.
Yes, and so last Monday, we released the request for applications for this next For CDBG, we're looking at approximately $1,100,000 for 2017. We have broken that out into $425,000 for infrastructure, $425,000 for social services, and of course we keep $250,000 that are set aside for the homeowner rehabilitation program. You know, that's as per our guidelines. For home, right now, we have an unusually large amount of funds that we have to allocate for home. It's approximately $1 million, which is almost three times as much as we sometimes get. And the reason for that is not because HUD has awarded more funds to the county. It's been pretty flat in terms of the new dollars that come. But if you recall, when we award home funds, we usually do it in the form of a low interest or no interest deferred loan. And there have been a couple of home loans that have been repaid in this recently. So we have more home funds that came in the form of program income that are available. So we have made, you know, in getting ready for this, and Rebecca especially has really done a fantastic job of getting materials together. I mean, we've worked as a team to review the applications, review the scoring. We've done some pretty mostly minor tweaking of the same Zoom grants application that we used last year. So when you review it, when you submit, if you're submitting and when you review it, it won't look or feel radically different. It will feel very, very familiar, and I'll go over the specific changes. But Zoom grants, the applications are updated, obviously. We've also made available in the library our application funding, you know, at the library for applicants to be able to access documents and review. The funding guidelines, CDBG and home project descriptions, the strategic plan goals from this consolidated plan, the census tract maps and tools, you know, all the documentations that are needed. The changes that were done to the application really apply to TBRA, home TBRA, the tenant-based rental assistance applicants. So, you know, last year that was, you know, Janice Youth, Share Aspire. And what the change is that they no longer have to submit a separate CDBG and home application for the same activity. So if you remember last year, they submit to home for funds for the actual rental assistance. And separately, they make a CDBG application under social services for dollars to fund case management that was associated to the same program. And what happened last year, you scored and ranked highly the home TBRA application and awarded those funds, and did not rank highly to the point that it would award funds with the case management. It was really the same program. So that's pretty, and that's not a criticism or comment on what you did. That lack of linkage, I think, is pretty confusing. So this year, for TBRA, the rental assistance funds and the case management are in the same home application. Any costs that they have towards case management will be reflected in the budget for home as CDBG, social service, case management dollars, so it will still be clear to you when you're looking. And what we as staff will do is we will take those funds that are requested from CDBG and set them aside until after the rank that gets done. So that's the major change. Timeline, if you didn't see the emails and timeline being promulgated, the pre-applications are due by October 31st. The applications are due December 1st. We're looking at doing the project review and program presentations on February 14th. The UCDV selection will happen March 14th. And we'll be expecting, as usual, HUD to do funding awards in July and with contract executions in August. So that's what we're looking at this year for 2017. Do you have any questions? And did I miss anything that you, that Sam and Rebecca, that you can think of? Okay.
Thanks, Michael.
I did have one question.
Sure.
How does the 425 for infrastructure compare to the last couple of years? It's a little less.
A little bit, but not much. So we made that change this year to go with taking the homeowner rehab off the top, which was actually what was in the guidelines. We just hadn't been doing it. We had been taking it straight out of the social service category. So it's probably about $100,000 lower than it's been.
Income survey presentation, Rebecca.
So in your packets, you'll see we have a new chapter 2 for the CDBG manual. When Sam and I were going through and we started talking about the income surveys and how prevalent they are now with the new American Fuel Survey, we wanted to make sure that we had it readily accessible for you to have the process written down. But then we also realized that our CDBG manual didn't really talk about the national objectives and eligible activities, and thought that that would be a really good thing to add. So the whole new chapters are regarding program objectives and eligibility, and then the income survey information that I'm going to present here is actually within this chapter. We're still fine-tuning the rest of the CDBG manual, renumbering all the pages and the chapters and things like that, but we will get this out and let you know when it's available on our website as soon as it's done. But this is a new chapter 2 for you guys to look at. So just a little bit of background that you guys pretty much already know. Back in 2014, HUD switched over from using the 10-year census data and going to using the American Community Survey data, which is a survey, not on hard facts. It's an estimate of what they believe is going on in each community based on the number of surveys that they get. They do actually survey millions of people each year, so they do get a lot of surveys in. They go after, they get about a 97% return rate on the surveys that they send out. We have 184 block groups here in Clark County, excluding the city of Vancouver. And when we did the census data, we had 57 eligible block groups. But when we went down to the ACS data, we lost 11 block groups, and that's pretty significant for our community to lose that many block groups that were just naturally eligible for coming into infrastructure specifically type projects. The income surveys, they've always been permissible. The center's done one in the past, several years ago. But now that we've changed the ACS data, the number of requests for doing income surveys has greatly increased. And that was the, what kind of said, let's do it right now. Let's make sure everybody's on the same page on how we need to do the income surveys. So this is just a general process overview, and I'll go in a little bit more detail on each of the aspects of it. The first thing you want to do if you're thinking about doing an income survey is to talk to staff. Because the first thing we're going to do is we're going to verify that your project is eligible, and we're also going to determine what the service area is, which normally is not the same as the project area. And so we need to take a look at what you're going to be doing to see what service area is affected, and the income has to be done in the survey, has to be done in the service area, not just the project area. We have template documents for you to use, so you're not starting from scratch. These have been approved in previous surveys. So just a minor tweaking, making sure it's your logo, that type of thing. We'll get that to you so that you can have that information. And then you'll submit the documents to us for review. And then once we say that it looks fine, we'll send it to our they will actually send us back. We have to wait until they approve the survey and the methodology, and then we'll get a letter that says you're approved to go move forward with the survey. And then once that happens, then you can conduct your survey. But do not start until we have an approval from HUD. So now going to a little bit more about the individual documents. So the survey letter is going to explain why we're conducting the survey. The main thing is to determine priorities. We do not want to go in and just ask them, hey, we're doing a survey. What is your income? They're not going to respond, right? They're not going to cooperate. So what HUD is recommended to do is for the is to have this survey be more focused around the priorities that your households and families are looking for, what they would like to see happen in their community, and then also ask them about their income. The survey letter should also say when the survey will be conducted, so you're going to want to designate a time frame. It's going to start on this date. It's going to go through this time frame. Who's going to be conducting those surveys? If it's going to be staff, is it going to be volunteers? Is it going to be council members? Those types of things. Let them know who they should be expecting to knock on their door, if that's the route you decide to go. Then how this survey is going to be conducted. Most of the surveys that have been done through the Urban County Policy Board and the jurisdictions has been door-to-door, which seems to be the most effective way because you're actually there, you're talking to people, and you're getting information. You can do by mail, and you can also do telephone interviews. Those are a little bit harder because then you have to somehow acquire those telephone numbers. So door-to-door is recommended, but there are other options that you can do. And then also make sure you discuss at least in one sentence that these survey responses are completely confidential so that they're not worried about where their information is going to go. So the survey, like I was mentioning, you want to start with that question that's talking about setting priority services. That way we're not scaring them when we first start talking with them. Make sure that when the survey takers, that they understand the difference between families and households. This is kind of one of those things that gets a hiccup when we're doing surveys. You can have multiple families within one household. So a household is everybody living under that roof. If it's a duplex, then it's that unit of that roof. But you can have two, three, even four families living within that household. If you have multiple families, then you need to do multiple surveys. You're looking at what the family's income is, for not just the total household. And with that income question, the income is based on the family's adjusted gross income from their tax forms. So that's, if you give them that information while you're talking to them, that kind of helps them understand what income we're looking for. They don't have to know it exactly, but to get an idea of what it is, they don't have to pull their tax forms or anything like that. And then you want to indicate a control number for each of those surveys, because we're going to come back and review them, and we need to know that this survey is going to this household that's linking to the map. And it also helps, so if there's any questions about a survey that was taken, you can easily go back to that specific household and say, you know, there's some misinformation on your survey, we just want to clarify, and that way you're not guessing which household it was, or going back to an entire street full of households to figure out which one it is. When we're having multiple families in that household, then you can use a control number like 2A, 2B, to indicate that there's more than one family within that actual household. The third document is a survey spreadsheet, and Excel is the best version to use because you can do your calculations right within it, and I will also go over those calculations, or whoever your staff person is that's working on your survey. In your survey spreadsheet, you're going to want to include that control number so we know which parcel that the survey corresponds to, the service address, the household size, and that is like that's the total number of, I guess that should be family size, I'm sorry, so that we know the number of people inside the family. If they're above or below the income limit, you can do yes, no, check boxes, and columns, it doesn't matter. And then this priority services is what we've seen in a lot of the surveys, and it's determine if the project is eligible.
If above or below the income limit, you just said, let's say it's 50,000, and you just say they're above or below, you just check a box?
Yeah, I don't need to know what income level they're at. I just need to know if they're above or below, how I'm going to calculate the numbers for it. And we'll go into the calculation sheet that I used that will help explain that a little bit better. So this is an example of a map that was sent on one of our surveys, and it was very clear and helpful, so I thought I would use this as my example. So this one outlines what the survey, the service area is. You'll notice that it does go outside the actual project area slightly. It's going up above by one household. Most of the time it's going to go out an extra street or at least a few households. This one, the way that it's set up in the neighborhood, it's only going out one. But it also shows clearly the projects that are going on, that we're doing sidewalks along these areas. And so it's clear to us what the project itself is. And then it's also telling us which parcels are commercial, residential, or vacant. If it's a vacant property, it doesn't count against you. So it's important that we know that. If it's a commercial property, we are looking to see if it's primarily a residential area, because if it's not, then it's not an eligible project. And then this one shows what the numbers from each of those residences are. So when they have, say this one has multiple families in it, they would put 1A, 1B, 1C. We know that they all belong to this location. If there were any questions, we could go right back to that one and get any clarification that we need.
Who did that? That's pretty nice. It wasn't like mine.
What's the definition of family? Because I think that's been confusing in some cases where they say, oh, we have
virus. We are also confused. There's been some conflicting information, but I do have some information, kind of what we decided to do as far as what the definition of family is. And it's up here a little further. But basically, if you claim them on your taxes, they're part of your family. So I'll use my household, for example. My father lives with me, and then I have my family, my husband, and two kids. My husband and me and my two kids are one family. My dad is not, I cannot claim him, so he is a second family. So we have two families living within our household.
Okay.
There's quite a few that are like that.
Yes.
I'd say more elderly adults with kids that they just are taking care of because the kids can't take care of them or something. So that's, I guess, two families.
If they're claimed separately.
Yes. So
if he doesn't claim, and some of the interviews that we had, I would have said that they were not claiming the kids.
Then
they would be two families.
That's two families.
Yeah. Essentially what the IRS states, and this is a very oversimplified definition, is that if you pay for over half of that person or family's expenses, then they are your dependent. So for my father, he's completely independent of me, so he is his own family. If that parent is taking care of their child and paying over 50%, and then there's some age restrictions and things like that you have to be careful of. But if they claim them on their taxes, then we would want to consider them as part of the same family. So asking if you claim them on your taxes is a really easy way of kind of disseminating that if they're a family, one or two families or three families. So this is the actual spreadsheet that HUD has provided to us to do the determine the income eligibility. So what happens is you submit all of the documentation that you've collected, including the surveys, to me, and then I go back and I look at your spreadsheet and I verify the information from each of the surveys on that spreadsheet just to make sure that everything is correct. And then we look at the eligibility based on the number of people in each family of each household. So this here asks you to enter the estimated total number of families in the service area. So this is even if you don't collect all your surveys, if you don't have 100% response rate, I still have to put in there based on that map that there were 27 households. And then I have to put at least one person for those ones that we don't know how many are in there. And then we enter the total number of families that were actually actually interviewed. Then we enter in the total number of persons in the families that were interviewed. And then this is the number that we're going to use to determine if they're meeting the qualifications. So this one says, this is the total number, this is the total number of low income that had said that they are below the income for their family size. We divide that, so those two numbers together, that's what we determine. And then that's the number that has to be over 51% for calculating the income survey.
So it's 51% of people, not 51% of households. Families or 51% of households?
Correct.
I think we probably didn't understand that last time we did it.
So there's, and that, yeah, and that's really important because you can have 10 households and you can have 6 households that are above income, but if they're only one person or two people and you have 4 households that are 4 to 6 people, you're going to be okay. You're going to meet that threshold. So it's really, it's the people within the families within that household. And you can also have 2 families within a household, one that's above and one that's below. So it's really important that you do a separate survey for each of those families.
And number.
And number them. So here's some things that we found as we were have been reviewing surveys. There's several surveys that have come through our office the last couple of years. So when you're determining if you want to do an income survey, if you have a smaller service area, you need to realize that you have to get 100% of response rate for it to be statistically valid. But if you have a larger service area, that's going to cost you more to do that income survey. So there's good and bad on both sides, pros and cons for having a smaller versus a larger, but larger versus smaller to make sure that you can get everybody's participation.
Is there a threshold for, or is there some kind of a chart that tells you how many, what response rate you need per survey, service area size?
Somewhere, I know Pete has seen it somewhere, and I would have to find it. But that's what happens when we send it to HUD. That's what they're checking for, is to make sure that, and they kind of let us know. Because once...
That's when they're looking at it ahead of time?
They look at all of them. You know, we submit them ahead of time, have to, every time. And I'm not sure, I'm sure there's some kind of documentation that they base, you know, some threshold. That's not shared with us, and it's not part of the documentation.
There's a CPD notice, and it might actually be in there. It's a pretty long CPD notice. It's where actually that exhibit that I have to use for the calculation is. And it might be in there, but I can look and see. We haven't had any issues quite
yet. Are you talking about what is statistically valid?
Yeah.
That's something that HUD determines. Like you can Google that. That's a common thing. Statistically valid survey.
I think it was in the CPD notice, but I can't remember. Because I know Pete showed me something.
So they use a confidence interval of 0.05?
Exactly.
Because there's different measures. Mm-hmm. So they use, okay.
What we found is so Richfield has done 2 surveys, and they've had almost 100% response rate on both of them. I think there was one that we had one household that didn't. So we knew that one was okay. When we did the Washington, that's right.
It's pretty interesting.
Washington, when we did your survey, we didn't have a very high return.
We didn't get the return. People weren't willing to do it, but we also didn't have the mayor and council members.
Twisted their arms. Yeah,
that's right.
We had staff do it.
So yours didn't go through because we couldn't hit the percentage because we didn't have enough households that would.
I'm just thinking about in the future. There's a sweet spot for a project. You know, you think your project is efficient to do the project like this, but it's inefficient to do the survey. So you might change your project, but you don't really know until HUD reviews it. However, now I'm understanding it's just there's not some special HUD definition for statistical significance. It's the standard 95% confidence interval.
Yes,
which you can get that number off of how many households, I guess, not families, because
you wouldn't know at that point.
Right. So you'd assume a 1-to-1.
The majority of them are 1-to-1, unless you know your area quite well.
Okay.
It is surprising how many of those houses are not one family. I mean, I was, I was pretty shocked actually at how many.
Probably 25%.
I'm, when you do every 4,000 and it's like you got two families or three families, and it's like, okay. I mean, I wasn't even expecting it. So,
yeah.
You don't know what questions to ask almost.
And that's where training of volunteers comes into play.
Well, they, you know, they, I'm not saying on my part so much, it's their reluctance. You know, I mean, nobody wants to say, oh, yeah, I make this amount of money, and I got all these kids, and or I have a parent, and they're reluctant to give. And I understand.
And you collect as much as you can. And if they're not willing to do two surveys,
they come to my door, I shut it.
The tax thing, I think that'll help a lot.
Yeah. To give an idea. You're not sitting there looking at your pay stubs.
Or trying to, you know, different people interpret a family as
right.
That'll really.
So then the third thing is to train your surveys, survey takers. So this is kind of important. So when you're training your survey takers, you want to make sure that they completely understand the reason and the importance for the survey. And part of that is that the main reason you want them to talk about to your the families is that we're determining priority facilities and services in your community. Because that's what's going to get them interested to take the survey, right? You have to be really careful. Although the information is going to support an application for funding, you want to be very careful when you say this because you don't want them to feel like, oh, we have to say we're over and fudge the information. That's the only way we're going to get the survey. So you want to be really careful and focus more on this that we're determining the priority facility, facilities and services. But when they ask you, why do you need my income? You can say that it's part of an application we're thinking about putting in for funding and kind of leave it as that. Make it, give them that information, but try not to go into too much detail because you don't want to influence what their response is. And then to make sure that they state that it's confidential. It is strictly confidential. Even though we know what households the information belongs to, when it comes back to us, that survey itself is not giving anybody information, if that's all they have as information to look at. So then I thought we should go into a couple of the questions that can get kind of confusing. So the survey question regarding how many families live in a residence. So the question is, how many families currently reside at this address? If more than one, a survey must be completed by each family. What we see on a somewhat regular basis is that this is indicated as the number of people in the family, and that's not what we're asking. We need to know how many families are in there, and then we know that we're looking for multiple surveys from that one location. And then this was that ask if they're independent on their taxes, and that's how you can help. This is not going to be 100%, and we understand that, and that's okay. HUD understands that, but we want to be as close to true as you can. So number four is the next one that gets a little confusing, and this is the one that we're actually finding out what their income is. Are they above or below their income level for the size of their family? So this is the specific question, and that's going to tell us how many people are in the family. And you want to make sure that you or the person filling out the survey is marking the box that corresponds to the number of people in the family. So we have some examples of what the survey shouldn't look like and what they should. So you can see that top one. I don't know if they make above 55,000 for a family size of four or below 49,000 for the size for a family size of three, because both of them were indicated. And these are true examples that I've seen come through, so it's not me making anything up. The second one, this is great. I love this. It's not required, but they're indicating to me, oh, there, it's family size of three. That's perfect. But the X is on row four. So are they really below 55,000 for their family of three, which I think is what they're trying to tell me, but I can't guess on that. Or are they really a family size of four, which then tells, it messes up my number of people in the family when I'm doing that calculation. So making sure that, household exceeds the household number 3, and they're below 49,950 income. So it's nice and easy to deal with. Any questions on that part?
I guarantee you they're not going to be easy. They never are the right perfect ones.
And it is. And that's when we come back and I'll say, you know, survey number this, this, and this. I'm not quite sure what's going on. And then you can either decide not to go back and we'll strike it as being income eligible, which goes against your percentage. But if you have a 100% response rate and there's only one or two that are like this, it might not be worth your time to go back out and ask them, and might have a high enough response without it. So those are the things that we'll talk about when we come back to review the survey.
So again, on that one, the second one, I don't understand why it's confusing. It says 3 people and it's below 55. So what's wrong with that? It doesn't fit if it's 3 and below 49. So what's worth the question on that?
So it's not 100% clear what size the family it is.
It's supposed to read those rows all the way across.
It says family size 3.
That's what I'm guessing.
Then they should be above 49,000.
Yeah, not below.
Then they should have checked above.
Are they between, do they make 51,000? And then they're above that one for family size of 3.
They're above 49. Could be.
It could be. We don't know.
So
they could be 30,000.
So that makes us question: should the 3 be circled or should the 4 be circled? Or did the person want to put the X in the below 49? Or that's why.
So basically, find your family size and then just read across.
Yeah,
correct.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that we want to look at. If you're a family size of 5, do you make under 59,950? Yes or no?
I think that real life example originally came from a survey filled out by an Onslow.
We do not know that. That I cannot know.
This presentation's actually for Ron.
Maybe.
And it's getting kind of close to home here.
Only because you've done so many surveys.
They weren't giving a threshold less than or equal to or greater than a number. They were trying to say, this is my salary. And they grabbed, probably is what they were doing.
Yeah.
I'm 3 people, and I make more than 49, but I make less than 55.5, so I guess that's what I'm supposed to do.
Exactly.
Because often, most of the time when you get a survey, and the income demographic data is requested, you put what your range of salary is, as opposed to just yes or no above.
Yeah.
You know, nominal data like that is different. So this is a kind of
a different
way to grab income data.
I'd recommend this style though, because it's less invasive on what their income is.
Right.
You're not putting them into
it's much easier to analyze.
So
it's yes or no.
And that's it. And that's all we really need.
It doesn't give you a good picture because it could be a house that says, there's 3 here, and I make about 49, below 150, but above 49, so
they're out.
It doesn't really give you a,
they're out.
But you don't put down 150, so.
Because it doesn't matter, it's just yes or no, that's all you need to know. Are you above or below a threshold? But you got to know the threshold in order to say you're above or below.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then you want to make sure that this gets updated. You know, if you've done a previous survey, you want to make sure that this is updated each year to the most recent data. Their median income tends to go up every year. However, we have seen it go down in the past, so we want to be careful with that.
How often do they update the threshold
every year.
Dollar amounts?
Is that the one that comes out in June-ish, the area median income? Do you remember? Yeah. It's never right around. It's in the same couple months, but it's never an exact
March.
Year. Is it March?
March or April.
There's several. And then we always send it out. We send that information out to the listservs saying that the information's been updated, and it's always in doubt, always go to our website and check it out or give us a call. This is another thing that we find that gets missed a lot of times is to make sure that you're putting your control number on the bottom of your surveys, because that's going to tell us that this control number, number 5, came from this parcel. So if we have questions, it's going to be easier for you guys to go back and ask those questions and clarify those surveys when they mark one household but a different income level. So the CPD notice about income surveys is CPD 14013. Here is a link to it, but if you just do a Google search of CPD 14-013, it will take you right to it. And it's a pretty long CPD notice with lots of information within it, so you can get some more details. But this is a general idea of what's going on for income surveys. So now we have a question for the board to answer. We've gone back and forth on this, and we've it's hard for us, and we don't want to determine this. We want to let the board make a decision. But the question is, when should surveys be completed? Before or after the application process? So on the one side, if it's before the applications are due, October 31st, we can verify that it's an eligible project, and it's less work for you guys to do as a review committee. However, that means you guys are putting in costs before you even know if you're going to get funding. That's the downside. If it's due after, afterwards, we would need it to be due by July 1st. We need to have a cutoff time, so we can get those taken care of. So we would give you till July 1st, and that way, if it doesn't become an income-eligible activity for us, we can easily divert those funds to another project. So then you have a certainty of funding. It's going to be extra work for the Urban County Policy Board for doing the reviewing. It could lead to spend down issues for us if we don't have another project that we can easily put those funds into. And we have to also keep in mind that HUD has to approve all of the documents before you can do the income survey. So that's why it could lead to a spend down issue for two different reasons. One, taking the time to do the survey, one, for HUD to approve it. Usually we get a response within 30 days.
They've gotten better. Doesn't have to approve the first one?
I'm sorry?
HUD doesn't have to approve the first one?
Oh, they have to. They have to do it. So we want to get, if the board decides that they want to do have it approved before October 31st, then you need to put in enough time, at least 2 months. One for 30 days approximate time that it takes HUD to approve it, and then another 30 days for you to actually do the survey, or however long it's going to take you guys. No matter what, HUD has to approve it beforehand. And so we say about 30 days. They've gotten a lot better. We've had one that, I think it was March, April, maybe, that it took like 4 months before they gave us a response that they were approved to move forward. I think it was Woodland. There was one that took forever. But now they're getting
So why would we do the 31st versus December 1st for the pre-application versus the full application, especially this year when we're already, into October?
This would be something that we go into consideration for next year. We're not going to push it. Gotcha. You got to get it done now.
No. That's a good question even for future cycles.
Yeah, and that's
pre-app versus app deadline for survey data.
When we were kind of going through the pros and cons on this, I think we were just thinking that it's either you're not putting in any work on the application if it doesn't go through at all versus thing. But December 1st, I don't think there's any reason why we couldn't have December 1st as a due date before that. So it just means that you would still have to get all of the documentation and administrative review stuff done. We usually at the pre-app is when we pull ineligible activities so that we're not even letting you go through all of the work to put the full application together.
Well, in terms of program efficiency, the October 31st date ensures the program's the most efficient because it's not reviewing something that's not eligible.
Well,
it's not even doing a preliminary review.
In terms of the survey, I mean, we will still do a preliminary review for other threshold stuff, but I think that the biggest efficiency or lack of efficiency really comes to the UCTV proposal reviews, because you're only going to get the proposals that we've verified are eligible. And this component of that eligibility piece, we won't have verified yet if you want to wait until after, you know, the, you know, for the after one. So you will receive, you know, you'll review more proposals, not necessarily a whole lot more, whichever needed the surveys. But, you know, really, we don't know, we can't guarantee a project is eligible until we know the results of the survey.
So each survey is good for just that particular year?
Correct. It's project specific.
So I'm thinking, but if you did a survey and it's eligible, or maybe not eligible, but it's close to being eligible, you at least have that background for if you wanted to redo the survey the following year to see if it changed the eligibility of the of that particular service area. I don't, it seems to me, I'm not sure we would want to review a bunch of applications that aren't even eligible.
And that was kind of the idea with October 31st. But we also understand that it's a cost that you guys are taking on before you even know if you're going to get funding.
And that's what we're asking.
So
yeah.
It's,
but the data is
not super cheap.
But you still have the data, even if it's a project that may or may not be eligible, you still have the information from that survey that may lead to future decisions with that particular service area.
We conducted a survey so we could see if an area was eligible. We could give that to the number of projects, eligible projects within that survey area. Because HUD said, oh, the census data said it's not eligible. And we went to determine if this area is eligible. And so it was eligible until the new census data came out. Is that not good anymore?
Oh, yes. No, that the information for the incomes, yes, you're correct, would be good every 5 years. So it's when the data is coming out.
So we didn't do a project by project. It's just that we believe that this area
now
really a low market.
We have to do it more project by project.
So
we can't do an area any longer. We had issues actually come back from HUD when we did the list center because we can't take in the entire area. It has to be service area specific as far as the information that we're doing. So
okay.
It's possible to do an entire city, like we did before. We did a city, right? But when we go yes, so we have to make sure that when we're evaluating each survey, which then that individual section still has to go to HUD for approval, that the only information we are using is for that service area, not the bigger area. So it gets more complicated to do a full city.
I think it should be.
Less?
But I agree with the mayor's sense to that. The data ahead of time before the John and I are to support the survey and the application.
Okay.
I agree.
And it's hard. And I mean, this is directly affecting you guys on both sides, reviewing or doing a survey ahead of time. So I guess we'll just have a vote on who would. Oh, yes.
Well, one other thing that is a little bit complicating, if you're doing it, if you're doing your survey before you apply, you also have to do your public input with two council meetings. So you have to back that up. You'll be starting that like in June, so as long as you can. I mean, so you get citizen comments on what they want to see, and then you get, and you say, this is what we're totally going to look at applying for, and then you start doing your survey, so that is also. I don't know if folks plan that far ahead.
So you have to do your public meetings before the surveys get done?
Well, if you're doing the survey, that's what you're
going to
apply for, and then you're
going to
ask
the public
what they would like your applications to be.
That we never get.
Well,
here's the other
how we do it.
We decide what we're doing. We ask, and no one says anything.
Also, Sam, wasn't there a change?
It's only been one last year, I think.
That's something that we kind of just let you guys slide on.
Oh, okay.
It's part of the presentation process.
But so here's the other thing, is if, so we do it, we say before October 31st. So we go out, we get it done. That doesn't qualify. So you say, oh, well,
now I'll
go to, you know, number two. And so now you're late. Now you don't have it. See what I mean? I mean, because you're going to go out and try it. What I really don't want to do is try to do the whole city to see what qualifies and what doesn't. But, you know, we got a couple of projects. I don't know whether I can complete with a couple of councils. I don't know whether I can complete both projects at a time.
Well, let me clarify that we are not going to instate this deadline this year.
Right.
So next year, the deadline will be in place. But this year, it's too late for us to go and switch it up on you guys when we know it's a two-month process and pre-applications are due at the end of this month. So this time, we can do the income surveys once the project, the awards have been selected. As soon as that happens, you're going to start thinking about your next year's application and do you need to do an income survey. This only comes to play if you need to do an income survey. And for Richfield, that's every time. until the new census information comes out. Not every jurisdiction is going to have, Washington lost quite a few block groups too.
But we're running out, we're running out of projects in those areas. Unless you start to do the ambiently universally eligible things and you just turn it into a curb cut program, which you can do.
I'll just be more money for our golf.
You're just doing curb cuts everywhere, which is a helpful program, and that might be what we do. But I did, real quick sidebar, is a census tract the same as a block group?
No, census tracts, block groups make up sense. So there's multiple block groups within a census tract. And the data that we have goes down to the block group level.
So eligibility before it was, it used to be based on census tracts, and eligibility was at the census tract level, or was it still at the block group level?
It was at the block group.
Oh, okay. So they used census data in block groups and made block group eligibility. And so the maps we would get were discretized below census tracts in the block groups.
Yes.
Got it. Okay.
And the American whatever survey, they're using the same.
Block groups,
but
yes.
It's a different. It's not census.
It's from a census broken down into each of the block groups per census.
But you said that we don't no longer use census income data. It's an American.
So it's the methodology that they used to collect it. So up until 2010, they used to send the long form census information to every household, every family in the household within the United States. Now they do a sampling, which is they do 3 million per state, I believe, in the survey. So it's still quite a few. And then they use that as their sample to expound upon that block group and that census tract. So it went from having almost every household help determine what the income and the block, so for the block groups in the census tract, to now to sample it. And that's why you saw such a significant change in the block groups and census tracts that are eligible. Because now it's just a sample. They do get 97% response rate. They send out the letters. They call. They show up at your door for anyone that has been selected to do the census tract. They put a lot of time and money into it every year to get those samples in. And then the 5 years worth of data is the most complete, yeah, that they'll have. So we always look at when they do the block groups for income eligibility, they look at the 5-year data. For very rural areas, they don't have that much information, so they'll do a 3-year or a 1-year. So that's how the American Community Service Survey data is broken down as 1-year, 3-year, 5-year. HUD uses 5-year data, which is why information is good for 5 years, but it has to be project specific for income surveys. Very confusing.
So could the methodology for this for a local be something that goes like this? We kind of know what we need to do. We have transportation plans. We have sidewalk plans. There's public participation to create those. We know which neighborhoods need these improvements. So we go out, we sort of carve out a service area, multiple ones, and we go do a survey. And it's out that service area is eligible. And then you can kind of carve a project into it.
How long the project is.
Okay, so we have to marry those two then. So we would marry those two. How long is that data good? Because thinking about lead time. You know, could we get a certified survey in year one and make application in year two, or does it have to be completed in the same cycle?
I don't know that I've been asked that question, and I don't think I've seen anything specific to it. We do know that from past. So when LaCenter did theirs back in 2000, early 2000s, it was good until the next census data came out.
But if you're doing a survey, I interrupted you.
Well, I was just going to say, so this came out in 2014, and in 2019, they're going to have the next data that we're going to use for creating those maps and knowing which ones are good. I'll do some research and find out, but I would assume that that information is good and it's relevant, but I'm not sure. When it comes to surveys, I'm not sure. Have you seen anything?
I would think it has to have the current, the appropriate income information for A, when the survey is taken, right, and B, at the time of application, it would have to be, it would still have to be a valid survey. So if you're doing a survey in 1 year and an application in another year, if you're determining the eligibility for that proposal based on information that is no longer current, I don't think HUD would accept that.
Yeah, they would. Unless there's been new ACS data released, they said you're now going to use this data, then you can use the survey.
Even if the income thresholds have changed?
Yeah, that was the same with LaCenter. They had 10 years.
You don't know until it changed.
So you could do a survey, and then if you didn't say you didn't, you know, selected that year, you could reapply using that same survey data the following year.
I think that's where we're going. We can always send an email to HUD and just to clarify it, but I that's where I'm leaning in where Sam's.
That's how it's been. How we did it with the center. And as long as HUD has at least the data, to start using this.
I think that would play into the decision here as far as before or after. I guess that makes me lean, if you can do that and HUD says that's fine, that leads to before a little more, because then you're not necessarily wasting that effort.
Mm-hmm. And I could also see a dynamic. The goal of this program is to deliver projects in our communities.
Yeah.
Right? And so this has become a barrier for us to achieve those goals in communities where everyone would look at it and go, we need a sidewalk. Right? So I could see you grab a service area with a project inside of it, and you're doing your best guess for survey data to put a viable project together.
Right.
You go do your survey based on responses or the actual data, it's ineligible. You go back to the drawing board and you say, wow, okay, we could do a smaller project with a smaller service area. We already have the data. This project will work. Mm-hmm. These three blocks don't get a sidewalk. Fun. I mean, that's the other fun. That's the dynamic that I'm kind of thinking work, as opposed to every single one is a one-off and you have to do a survey.
Yeah.
I'm going to a curb program problem, you know, just curb cuts, because I think that's going to become untenable. But if you can morph like that, then I think that would work. But you need at least a year probably to put that up. And as long as we've got some time, and as long as we know when that next data dump is, then we can plan around that as well.
Yeah, HUD said 5 years. They're using the data for 5 years. Even though it updates every year, it's already updated in September. There's 2015 ACS data available now. They said 5 years is how long they're going to have this information available. So we know that it won't come out until 2019.
But
even ADA is not automatic.
No.
I mean,
well,
you can't just go and say, okay, I'm going to this section of the street.
You have to remove an architectural barrier. So you cannot bring it up to code.
Right.
But if there's no curb cut there currently, then it is eligible because you're removing an architectural barrier.
You can't redo one, but you can build
it. Correct.
So if you have a ramp that's not compliant, tough.
Maintenance.
But if you don't have a ramp at all.
Right.
When we talk about the surveys being eligible from year to year, how do you know that the demographic in the household or the neighborhood hasn't changed from year to year?
There's not any.
The
likelihood that you have a significant change from 1 year to the next is pretty low. I mean, you'll have some turnover in the house and also depends on how many of them are rental versus homeowner. But
it's not a significant enough difference to have it be a it's not a significant enough potential difference to have it be
a hindrance.
Potentially it's a 5-year window.
Potentially.
And then it'll be a 4 and then a 3 and then a 2 and then a 1 and then a none and then a 5 window again depending on when you do
it. Right.
So you're thinking you would take your sidewalk plan and do some selected surveys around there and have that help shape your project.
And then learn from the first sequence of it, because it's a big effort to get a survey going. So, you know, to add 10 houses is easier than to do a whole nother one, even if they're both smaller, in my mind. So
we just have to make sure that it's whatever that final project is what HUD is approving for the survey. We also want to take into consideration that once the new data comes out, which is usually in September of the year, when HUD switches over, that means if you were eligible beforehand, but now you are not, which is what happened with Washington. They were eligible. The new data came out. They were not eligible any longer. They had to go to do the survey. So you want to keep that into consideration when you're coming up to that 5-year deadline.
Well, one potential hiccup to that method, too, is that if you have to show your service area and your project sort of laid over that service area and send that to HUD for approval, then you're going to be pretty limited in how you can tweak the project.
Well, what would happen is you do it and you're ineligible. You look at it and you go, oh, I can see why we're ineligible. This block right here. Okay, so let's take this block out of it. Let's reduce the project. And then they won't let you use that data. You have to ask the same people the same question.
You'd at least have to resubmit
your service area back to HUD, and they'd have to say, okay, now you're not.
Yeah, that's
fine. And that's why one of the first things we want you to do is when you're thinking about a project that you know is not in an eligible census tract block group, come talk to us first. Because then we're going to sit down and say, this is the project that you want to do. This is the service area. So I've done that already with Canvas this year. They have the one project in Franklin Street that they're finishing up from last year's funding. They wanted to do the end cap. That street that's down at the end is actually the edge of their block group. The other one is not eligible. There's a school at the end of that street. So their service area is not just that street and a few houses around it. It is exploded because there's a lot of kids walking to school. It's not a viable survey for them to do at this point. So unfortunately, it's right there on that border. It's a street they would love to do, especially because they have kids walking to school. It just isn't feasible to do an income survey for that project. And the likely, because it's a higher income area around it, a significantly higher income area around it, we knew, talking with Jim, that it wasn't going to pan out. It's not worth it for you guys to put the time in it. So we will talk it through with you. If it's close, we're going to sit there and leave that decision to you. But in that situation, I told him I said you could still try it, but I didn't recommend them doing that. So now they're looking for a different project. But that's the first thing. Come talk to us, because we're going to sit down and we're going to look at that service area, and then we're going to go to HUD and make sure that the methodology is correct. And that's another reason why we provide you all those templates. Do not start from scratch. Use these ones that have already been accepted by HUD and tweak them to put your names in them and what little details you need to change to do your survey, and you've already got that information. So the biggest part of it is creating the map on what the service and project area.
That's our hierarchy. EG is a process. Sometimes it's the other way around.
Are there any other questions that I can answer for you? Do you feel comfortable making a decision either October 1st, December 1st, or afterwards? It sounded like everybody was kind of leaning towards having it due before the applications are due. That's the consensus.
Personally, can't speak for everyone, but I'd like to hear from HUD for sure that survey data isn't basically wasted if our project, you know, isn't selected before making a decision myself.
Okay.
Which point, October?
Right, I mean, I'm leaning towards October, but if HUD says, no, sorry, if you do your survey, you apply for funding, and your project isn't selected, and And then if you want to do that project again next year, you've got to redo the whole survey, start basically from scratch again.
Or if it's if you can modify it and just resubmit it.
Right.
Well, and this decision is for next year's timing, correct?
Yeah. It would be.
Yeah. So if we could get a confirmation from HUD, I mean, I think right now it seems like we're sort of nodding that October, that the survey's done before. But if that changes, we can always...
Based on information.
Yeah, we can always revisit in January.
So from the CPG notice that I just looked up on my phone, lifespan of a survey, there is no firm answer as to how long an income survey for the purpose of determining the percentage of LMI persons with service area is good for. Perhaps there might be instances in which an income survey could continue to be used until the next decennial census, but the grantee would have to be sure that there may have been no significant demographic, economic, and non-economic changes in the area during that time. Such changes may include things such as factory openings or closings, layoffs by a major employer in the service area, or occurrence of a disaster. So
when we were going back to that 5 years, that's I guess would be our final answer.
So there's been no factory closures.
So yeah, as long as there's not any reason, you know, the port all of a sudden fell into labor or something, we're not going to worry about it. So there's our safety, Sam. So our answer is your survey will be good until the next data release is by half.
Okay.
And we think internally we could morph that. Well, yeah. So then we just morph it, and we have the responses.
And then we can resubmit it to HUD for their approval, and that 30 days plus whatever time it is to do this additional, or if there are additional households to be, then you have time.
It almost begs the question: whether if all of us are in the situation at the beginning of each 5-year period, somehow we do some sort of a survey for communities.
They have to be project based, so you have to know what the project is beforehand.
No, but what I'm saying is we can just go out and do a survey, right? Get preliminary information. We just go out
that the target
and get the same information, but it's not a 100% survey. But it's
just
a
foundation
of information.
Then you know your projects are.
And we're like, we know where our projects are, and you start rolling those out.
Then you do the individual insert surveys.
Then you describe a service area under the project, and you say, well, I already know their income.
But it's not this survey. It's not a HUD-approved survey.
Yeah, but all you do is use their survey, then. You take your information and put it on their survey.
I didn't hear anything.
So then this whole thing may not work. What we're saying is create a project with a service area, do the survey. It doesn't work. We make a slightly smaller, largely smaller service area project, but it's basically the same project. It's just the sidewalk's not as many blocks of sidewalk. That has to go back to HUD to get approved. And then you have to go survey again, or can we use that data again?
You said we could use
the data.
If you already have the household survey, you don't have to go back and ask them the next month.
Yeah.
As long as it's the HUD survey, and it's not your
approval.
Yeah, it has to be the HUD approved survey. Because with this process, you're not allowed to start surveying until HUD approves the message, all of that information.
Can you go back to the map, that example map? So. So say you do this survey, and it turns out that the north end there is throwing you off. So 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. So you could then come back and say, okay, I'm drawing the line at, what is that street there? Right at the church there, I guess. And you could reuse the survey, as long as it was a HUD-approved survey.
Yes.
But you couldn't necessarily do a preliminary.
But you couldn't then say,
just to get an idea of where
you're going. I guess this street, you couldn't say we're going to add in this street here, because now you have to take into consider this. Then we have to go back to HUD, because you're now adding households in the
service
size.
You have to
reapply
anyway, so why you could.
You could, you just have to survey those people.
You just have to add them.
And then you have to
HUD them. And then you have to HUD them.
The application has to be specific.
And that's why it's the service area, not the project area.
Yeah.
So it could work, or there could be circumstances where it wouldn't work because the service area changed because of where you cut back. It's like, you cut it back, but it doesn't matter. The service area is the same because of the streets.
So people walking down this part of the sidewalk are still those households up there. They're still going to be the ones that are benefiting from these sidewalks right now. So it depends.
So
now,
how far
if you decide you want to do this here, then we can cut these two off, right? Because we're still, you still have this sidewalk, so you still have the benefits here. Sorry, I'm not calling them. But you could cut this off because your service area is smaller. Your service area.
Right.
And your project area.
It's not a perfect strategy, but it's got some efficacy maybe where you don't have to do another little survey.
You could supplement or call.
You may have to, depending on the service area. And then just talk to us. Because we'll sit there and we'll sit down and we'll map it out and we'll figure out what's going to work best. So that's why the very first thing, come talk to staff.
Still thinking about it. This might really be some data up the front.
If you wanted to invest in that, having that survey for, you know, a large area, I think that's a viable thing to do if you want to put funding into doing that. But then just know that when we come down to looking at the actual project for the actual application, that's when we have to look at, and then you have to start the survey process for those households again. Any other questions? Okay, so now that we know that we can use it until the new data comes out, are you guys comfortable making a decision?
For next cycle.
For next cycle?
Yeah.
So before or after? Before applications due?
Before.
December 1st or October 31st?
I think you got to put the time I think we should do. I think
we might as well. Yeah.
October 31st.
October 31st.
That'll save staff from doing the
full. I think that's the fairest thing for everybody. Mm-hmm.
Well, it also gives you 30 days to have submitted HUD to make sure that they've approved everything, don't you?
So you would want the whole survey process to be done by October 31st, so we know that it's all
well, you still have some risk that...
You're not going to get funded.
No, but that we could be funding a project that with a survey that isn't approved.
No.
But so
for this year, we will.
This year, not next year. So if we have it that your surveys are due 100% complete October 31st, we will know that it's already been approved by HUD, and you've done a survey.
Okay, so you're saying October 31st includes having sent it up to HUD.
So we know 100% that it's an eligible project.
So that works.
Yeah. So start during the survey.
And you're somewhat dependent on how long it's going to take for HUD to review it.
Which has been about 30 days. Like I said, when they first rolled over to this new data, it was taking months.
And that's why I was thinking that the survey was submitted by October 31st, so that hopefully by December 1, you would have gotten HUD's comment.
Then you have to have enough money and approved by the board.
Yeah. But so you're saying, you know, it's accelerating it so that you actually have the HUD process.
So the full surveys have been done and submitted to staff and reviewed by staff.
So you probably should submit to HUD by mid-September.
Yeah.
Depends on how long it takes and how large the survey is.
It takes 30 days. What if it takes them 6 weeks?
So
it would be a shame that on November 4th you get your approval.
We can, yes. We can, once your surveys are completed and submitted to us for review to verify that you meet the income threshold, that information for us isn't generally difficult for us to review and give you a response rate like within a day or two if we're in the office, whatever's going on, but that we can say, yes, it's 100%, you meet the 51% threshold. But if we have to go back and say, this survey is confusing, this one's not complete, then it's going to extend the timeline. Once you get us the completed surveys, we can review it within a couple of days. And if, you know, like I've been working with Rich Hill for the last couple of years, if I'm not in the office and we know it's a tight turnaround, Sam's most likely going to be available. I'll be like, hey, Sam, here's all the documentation. Can you please run it through and make sure that it works in the spreadsheet? And she can give you, or Mike, we'll make sure we get it to you in as quick fashion as we possibly can. That part of it is not tend to be very difficult.
So should we set a deadline where the deadline's actually like we have to do that with you?
That's what I was just thinking.
As opposed to, I think Pete's got a good point. You know, not penalize each other because HUD took 8 weeks this year, not 4 weeks.
And we can't control,
control
the timing of HUD.
Yeah. We can bug it. At 30 days, I've been known to bug HUD every day.
Because it would seem to me that if you submitted it to you by October 1, possibly you would have HUD's approval by October 31st, but you most certainly would have it before December 1. Excuse me.
When you actually go back out to do the actual surveys.
No.
Oh,
we're not talking to
you. I'm talking about the, you've completed the survey. And it needs to be sent up to HUD. So you've gotten their approval to proceed. I'm sorry, I got caught with it. The post approval.
I don't think there is a post approval.
There's no post approval. Once we do our evaluation, it's done. So you have HUD's approval. So we send the templates to HUD. And then they, within usually 30 days, get back to us saying, your methodology is approved, then we tell you guys, go do your surveys.
Okay.
You do that project, that part of the project, submit all of that back to us, and then within a couple of days from submitting that, we can have it evaluated and verified that you're meeting the 51% income threshold, and then you can submit your application.
So you're going to have to submit it back in July or something.
Yeah.
So I would recommend that you get it to us no later than September 1. That gives 30 days or so for HUD to approve, and then if you can do your surveys within October, but if the earlier the better. But I would say that is your drop dead. You don't want to go any later than September 1 to get us the information to get it to HUD.
It'd be nice maybe to have a little calendar developed.
Would that be possible just to put together sort of a little timeline of recommended and then drop dead dates for this process for the?
Yeah, we could easily put that in the guidelines for the.
And then maybe just a reminder to the board.
Now, I think you can get HUD approval within 2 weeks.
Ron, you could have practice.
Yeah.
And I will say, Richfield gets great response rate, but Ron and the council members are out there, and people are like, oh, I got you in front of my face, right? I'm going to, yes, you want this information, now let me tell you.
Exactly. Careful what you ask for.
So we do it every 2 years.
Okay, so we'll move forward with October 31st being when we need to have a completed survey. Moving forward, we'll get that in the guidelines. We'll get you a little table in there so you know.
Recommended timelines.
And then if you have any more questions, want to sit down with, just contact us and we'll come out and talk with you guys.
Dave's got it too. He says, you know, when I go to run for office again, knock on a door. I'm running for office, and by the way,
there you go.
Okay. All right. Rebecca, thank you very much. Yeah. Any other items from board members? Entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Adjourn. Thank you.
So right after this, we're having our CBG pre-submittal meeting, and we recommend that you stay.
You
can. There hasn't been a whole lot of changes to the RFA, but there's been a few tweaks that we've made, and it's always good to have the information on what we find. We give Q&A, so things that we have to be bugging applicants to come back for, we'll have that information
to
you.
Have
a
good weekend.